Only when it's recorded, and I'll go.
Or if you want, you could repeat your first slide at the very end.
Basically, well, how do I get to the audit down here? Maybe I just push return. Okay, good. All right. So this is the topics I'll discuss. And of course, this is the first topic. The tokamak shut down without disruptions. What you find is there's remarkably little written on the shutdown here. The key paper, by the way, these numbers are at the end of the talk. If you look at the slides, and I hope they'll be made available to anybody that wants them. Certainly, I'll be happy to give them to anybody, or the references. But this reference, again, in detail, it's called Control Shutdown of Heater Discharges. DeVries is the lead author and a whole pile of authors in Nuclear Fusion 2018. What you find in any fusion plasma, any big plasma where you're not doing heavy neutral beam heating to control the current, is that current profile control is difficult, but it takes a very long time to evolve on ETER, about 15 minutes. So, of course, if I want a plasma that's just 15 minutes long, I can just do carefully put the current in by controlling the loop voltage. But what I do after that to control the current profile, that's what one has to think about. If it starts evolving in a very dangerous way, some way that you know is going to cause some big MHD mode or instability, then plasma termination is the obvious strategy. But the big problem, the biggest problem, is to terminate the ETER plasma. You have to explain how you're going to get the roughly 60, 70 volt seconds of colloidal flux out of the chamber into somewhere. Now, there are only two mathematical Faraday's laws, so there are only two possibilities. One is you take it out at the magnetic axis, and the other is that you take it out at the edge, and I'll discuss that in just a second. What reference one claims is that you can get a controlled plasma shutdown from 15 megamps to below a megamp in 60 seconds. But if you actually read the paper, they don't go into detail where that number came from. What they do say is they did runs with Corsica and Dina, which gave a rapid shutdown in 210 seconds, which is four times longer. But even that is a problem. Okay, so how do you remove all this colloidal flux? It's the ENM is very simple. All you've got to do is you've got 60 seconds of volt seconds of colloidal flux. You give me the loop voltage, and you can do a trivial division and get the number of seconds. And there are two places where it could be. One is the magnetic axis, and that just says the loop voltage is the 2 pi r eta j, the integrating around the axis of circle, so it's trivial to do. And if you're at 15, it takes 15 minutes. If you're at 10 kilovolts, is basically the answer you get. The other way you can do is pull it out through the wall. So you want to do it in 60 seconds. You have a 1 volt loop voltage in the backward sense on the wall, and that will suck out the colloidal flux into the transformer. But what happens when you put a negative voltage on at the edge is you drive a negative current at the edge. And this can produce all sorts of instabilities, but these are not really in a Corsica or Dina simulation, which are 2D simulations. The instabilities are, of course, 3D things. The other thing you get into when you start fooling around with this, trying to yank the flux out into the transformer, is that you tend to get a very large internal inductance. Now, what you mean by the internal inductance, the very large internal inductance means you peak the current heavily on axis. And the higher you make the internal thing go up, very high. Put it all, try to put it like in a wire at the axis. But what that means is the axisymmetric position control is very difficult, and it's very highly associated with disruption. So you don't want to operate with an extremely high internal inductance. You're essentially guaranteed of problems. By the way, see, what was I going to say something, but I guess it's okay. And these are more additional issues. One of the big issues is the Green Wall density limit, that the plasma particles have to be removed from the chamber. Otherwise, you're very quickly going to run to the Greenwald density limit because you're trying to rein the current down. And of course, the Greenwald, Martin Greenwald said, well, the density has got to be less than his number, which is proportional to the plasma current. And of course, the plasma radius is A is more or less whatever it is. And the question is, how do you do that? Well, the pumps can't pump out particles super fast out of the chamber. And so, but how quickly, if I start sucking down the current real fast, how am I doomed to disruption unless the pumps can keep up with it? I don't know if anybody's really come up with a definitive answer. I'll get back to this later. When you're trying to run away electron control, you find understanding what happens if you are way above the Greenwald density limit, how quickly you get disaster, is a critical issue that I have not been able to find anybody who claims to know they have the answer to the practical things. The next thing is you get a transition from H to L mode, or you can get a transition from H to L mode, which is sudden and can complicate position controls. In a burning plasma, the DT power production drops basically as T squared. And basically, as soon as you start reducing the temperature, you turn off the nuclear power. And that means you cannot replicate it with auxiliary heating. In principle, you could, but an ETER, the nuclear power, even the alpha particle of it, is way above the neutropene power. And so, if I just slam down the power really fast after I've tried to shut down the machine, what happens? Well, most people tell you this is not at all good for avoiding a disruption. So anyway, we have to figure out what we're going to do about that. The interaction of a plasma with that had a strong shaping before the disruption started can be very fast. Boris Breisman, I've forgotten his collaborator on that, showed that if you have an ideal wall, you still get shoved into the wall on the resistive timescale of the plasma. And the reason for that is fairly obvious, that you cannot, if you have a perfectly conducting wall, whatever was the vertical field before you started this process is the vertical field throughout the process. But the vertical field you need to keep a tokamak centered depends on the plasma pressure and the current profile and the current. And so you've got the wrong vertical field. And if it were a simple circular plasma, you tend to slam it into the inboard side. But in a diverted tokamak, the tendency is to slam it into one of the diverter chambers, not pleasant. And it's more subtle. What you mean by the conductivity of the wall is extremely subtle in ETER and probably any machine at that scale, because there are tiles, blanket modules, and all these sort of things. Now, the tiles, which have recently switched from beryllium to tungsten, but the conductivity isn't that wildly different. Though there's references, some of the references here to talk about the beryllium tiles. The beryllium tiles, even though they're separated off from one to another with cuts, they can act like a single valued current potential or something. They're like little dipoles. And for about 20 to 40 milliseconds, they aren't just a purely passive partner. They cannot carry net currents around, net toroidal flow currents, but they can certainly affect the normal magnetic field. And then you get back into the big modules, big stainless steel modules. They also have a very funny role. And then what really provides a real good conductivity is this big stainless steel thing that controls the vacuum way back. But it's a very complicated situation, which really hasn't been fully simulated. Then it gets more complicated. If you say, well, it's a disruption, I slam plasma into this thing, the gaps between the tiles are not going to stay insulating. And so you'll run currents in funny directions. And it gets even more complicated if you tell me that you've had some runaway electrons or something and melted a few tiles together, because then the currents will want to go, may want to take a shortcut through these melted regions, which means you can take toroidal currents, convert them into ploidal currents, which makes the J cross B force 10 times greater locally, but it also increases the J because the current wants to go through whatever this layer little melt region was. And people really haven't gone through that and tried to figure out all the implications. But before you really deal with machine, before we deal with it in real life, we need to understand that. The next thing is you have to control the power flow onto the wall. That if for some reason your plasma goes to the wall and dumps all the power locally, like it's effectively thinking a piece of the wall is a limiter, then you melt the wall and do all sorts of horrible things. And so somehow you have to tell me how you're preparing to address that question. Now, the one thing that is semi-good is at 3 megamps, somewhere along in there, currents get low enough and everything is weak enough that you can just kind of let it rip like you do in most machines normally now, because we're generally operating, you know, at relatively low currents. But the problem, most problems, force problems go up and power problems go up quadratically with current, but one of runaway electron problems go up exponentially with current. And so a very tiny change in current can, you know, make life, you know, which wasn't so bad before, impossible. Okay. What this says is, of course, you know, theorists, I can go off and calculate. You may believe me, you may not believe me, but probably not. But the question is, can you simulate these things with present day experiments? One of the big differences between ETER and or Spark or any of these things, and any machine that exists right now, is the time it takes for the magnetic field to penetrate the walls. It's more than an order of magnitude different in ETER. In some cases, essentially 2 orders of magnitude than in and in power plants than existing machines. The loop voltage, vertical to shaping fields, the heating powers can be altered in existing machines to play games as things drops. But and you can do things to deal with HL transmission. Transition by changing the heating power, but these are not possible in ETER, certainly in the burning plasma period. And so you have to think through what your strategy is and what parts of the strategy can be tested. Now, you could test quite a bit with existing machines by simulating these effects. For example, highly conducting walls can be simulated by adjusting the coil currents outside so that they keep some number of Fourier components or whatever of the normal magnetic field fixed. Or it's actually what you should do is calculation and figure out which components of the normal magnetic fields on the walls are most important and try to keep those fixed. You can also study what would happen if you had a sudden loss of DT power by just, you know, slamming down your neutral beams to nothing. And you know, what does that do to disruptions? Most people say it's not good, but okay, that's why it needs to be studied, because, you know, we should not wait till we have an ETER plasma there trying to turn it off when we're just studying what you do. Okay, so now what I'm switching is to a third topic, which in very much involves the runaway electrons. It's the reformation of magnetic surfaces after disruption. Now, normally we think of a disruption as breaking the magnetic surfaces. You can have a disruption of a different character, where if I drop something in there, that you just cool the plasma very suddenly, and it isn't necessary you break the surfaces, but normally that's what happens. But I'll be discussing what happens if you get a disruption that breaks the surfaces. What will happen is very quickly, the J parallel B will go to a constant. That's what happens when the magnetic field lines become chaotic in a region. And of course, you'll lose the thermal energy. So both of those disappear on a very fast time scale. What you find is, why is it such a fast time scale? Well, the remarkable thing is if you apply an ideal perturbation to a axisymmetric tokamak, but it's a non-axisymmetric perturbation, then you get a very complicated shaping of the magnetic surfaces, far more complicated than one would naively expect, that you can find the places where the surfaces will get very close together, crushed together, other places where they're very far apart. They get crushed together at the places where the X points would be if you could break the surfaces, but with an ideal perturbation, you cannot. And they get very far apart at the places where you'd expect the O points to be. And what happens is by applying it, a very simple situation of pure thing, pure harmonic, you get all these harmonics on top of it. If I put a 2-1 on, I'll get the 4-2, you know, the 6-3, all these things coming out. And then I couple it with the axisymmetric shaping of a tokamak, and I get all the different M numbers. So what you find, if you drove one thing, one rational surface, it will immediately create perturbations to drive all the other rational surfaces. And when your perturbations get up to surfaces, take on these incredibly complicated shapes, they preserved in ideal MHD, but they take on these complicated shapes on however fast you're turning on the ideal perturbation. And what that means is all I have to do to break the surfaces is to get the places where the surfaces are close together, get close enough together so eta over mu naught can diffuse phi-lines. It's just a diffusion coefficient between different surfaces. And what that basically says is a time scale for breaking up all your surfaces is like an ideal evolution time, which can be as fast as alphanic, times the logarithm of what's called the magnetic Reynolds number, which has to do with the speed and size of the system times speed divided by eta, basically. It's about 10 to the 7 for something like ITER. So 10 to the 7 is a huge number. Its natural logarithm isn't all that big. It's, you know, it's about 20, but it's, you know, you basically, the natural logarithms are all big numbers, or about 10 or 20 or something, but you can never get the number all that long. It takes an order of magnitude longer than a sure alphane time, but that's all, break up all the surfaces. Now, these disruptions are so fast that the normal field remains axisymmetric on the wall, certainly in something like ITER. But you take away the drive for the kinks because J prime Rubigo is constant. There are two drives for kinks. This is a theory thing, but it's fairly clear just energetically. One is J prime over B, and the other is grad P, and you get rid of both of those. And so an axisymmetric equilibrium is favored. That is the minimum energy state of the system. If I give you axisymmetric boundary conditions and whatever, all of the stuff, you naturally favor an axisymmetric solution. That is a low energy state. So they tend, magnetic surfaces tend to reform, but the physics and math are very different from breakout. The ideal flows are not important for reformation, and the time scale is presumably proportional to eta, not compared to an ideal evolution time. This is like a problem we've all faced or dealt with. If you have a can of paint, as you know, if you leave it for a few weeks, the colorant and it will tend to go to the bottom, and you have the carrier, you know, is in the rest of the can. So if you want to paint your door again or something, you have to get in there and stir it around. You don't have to stir it very many times because it works the same way as here. It works that the stirring, it's on the stirring time, maybe 10 times the stirring time, you mix the colorant in with the paint. Now, if I want to get it separated again, you can, as you probably know, you can paint all day on your door and it doesn't really do that much separation on you. What causes the separation is that the colorant is a little denser than in most cases, than the carrier. And that means that it's energetically favorable for it to go to the bottom of the can, but it's just a different, slight differences in forces that cause it to go to the bottom of the can. And stirring the can is not going to help this out. The only way you can help it out, of course, is put in a centrifuge to make these forces or energetic differences greater. And so you have the same issue in a tokamak after the minimum energy solution is an axisymmetric equilibrium. But ideal MHD says you can't form surfaces, you can't break them, you can't form them. So you have to get the resistivity involved. Really very little theory or experiment has been done on this. And so, but it's a very important issue. And the reason is I'll explain why you should get excited about this issue. It's the effect of surface reformation on runaways. There are two things to get runaways if you have a big current machine. It requires confinement. If the runaway electrons immediately go out, you know, okay, fine, you can't get them to run away to very much energy. And if you're starting out like with standard ITER density, et cetera, in let's say 10 kilovolts, you need to get down below 500 eV very quickly. What happens is if you get below 500 eV real quickly, your resistivity gets so big that it can take the tail electrons, the high energy tail of 10 keV, and cause them to start efolding. And basically, it what I point out in the second line, is runaways increase their number by about a factor of 10 for each megamp drop in the current. So we get 10 to the 15 as a maximum out of ITER. It turns out to solve the problem of dealing with the thermal energy in the plasma, you tend to want to put some impurity in to make it radiate and come out uniformly over the walls. The trouble with that is you look at argon or neon, the obvious things, you find that you actually increase the amount of current you get. You get 100 times the number of runaway electrons per megamp. So you go from 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 30th. Well, it takes a while. You have to play with the numbers a while before you realize having a number 10 to the 30th. If you get one electron in there, it can take over the whole current very quickly. That only takes about 15 or 20. So you put one high energy electron in, and you can be had. In a non-nuclear device, hot tail electrons are the only seed, and the runaway must occur in about 20 milliseconds for that seed to survive. Otherwise, it will just rejoin the Maxwellian at a low energy, and it turns out it's called the Dreiserman. It makes 10 to the 34 look like a small number, and so you don't need to worry about it. However, when you get to a nuclear device, the world is a different place. Even tritium decay contributes enough electrons, steady state, because you aren't going to get the tritium out real quickly when a disruption occurs, to cause you to run away. But those are not so high energy. The ones that are really bad are the gamma rays, that the walls become radioactive. It's hard to... There have been some studies, and you can find little cursory things and odd places in papers, but it really hasn't been looked at with the care it needs to be. The gamma, what happens, you create funny isotopes in the walls from various things, probably impurities, and they decay radiatively, just like atoms do. And instead of the energy of the two levels being separated by EV, they tend to be separated by roughly an MeV. And this gamma ray can come in and hit an absolutely zero energy electron and knock it up to roughly an MeV. And there are not many of these, but if I multiply by 10 to 15, you can get a huge number. And 10 to the 34, it's incredible. And so you really, it's quite a different world when you get to a nuclear device. So we need to understand this stuff before we try to do nuclear experiments. The runaway danger is very different depending on whether, when you start reforming magnetic surfaces, whether the first surfaces that form are on the outside or whether on the deep interior. It can go either way. And people have seen it different ways in computational simulation. But the runaway danger is very different. If you have an inside-out reformation, the runaway electrons are on magnetic surfaces. And if you put the runaway electrons on magnetic surfaces, it's hard to figure out how you get them to localize. And localization is the whole issue. If you go through how much energy there is in a runaway, suppose I took an ITER, suppose I convert all 50 megamps into runaway electrons, the typical energy you can show is around 10 MeV. And so if you just compare that to the background, we found about you need about one part in 10,000 of electrons. It's like 10 to the fourth to carry the runaway, to carry the full ITER current with relativistic electrons. You find that the energy in the runaways is only about 10% of what the thermal energy was in the plasma before the disruption. So if you tell me you could somehow handle that energy, why can't you handle this energy is the obvious question. And the answer is it would be okay if it weren't localized, but if it gets highly localized, I can take a very tiny amount of energy and burn a peak, and burn a good sized hole with a lot less energy. It does also say you have to be careful about localization if you don't use radiation of the thermal energy in the plasma. But if you use radiation, or it's by argon or something, hydrogen doesn't radiate very much once you get above about an EV or so. So, what are you going to do? Anyway, outside in allows extremely localized deposition. And that's where you have runaways in a chaotic core, which means the field lines just, go around in the core any way they like, kind of covering the core after enough coronal transits. And then there's an annulus that prevents them from getting to the wall. And that's what you definitely do not want to have to deal with. it seemed to be favored where the resistivity is high near the plasma edges, of what you expect even on a chaotic plasma, that, you know, you cool down enough. But anyway, there's still some parallel thermal resistivity, and so the edge tends to be have a higher resistivity than the core. Now, it could be mitigated, and this is what they plan to do at Kalmuck Fusion. If you can induce currents in the walls to produce strong 3D fields, or something I suggested 10 or 11 years ago, but ITER is not going to do that. They decided not to. That's one of the few ways you can try to make sure this doesn't happen. But when the runaways fill a chaotic core confined by an annulus, the annulus can be punctured, and it can be punctured in various ways. It can just be pushed into the wall. And of course, when you push it into the wall, even if it's a, you know, axisymmetric push, you hit something first, and you create a hole in the annulus. You can also have a kink, which will push someplace to the wall, same issue. Or you can have a resistive instability, which is internal to the annulus, which is breaks it up. You can, any of these things, they work slightly differently. And I give a reference down here where you can look up some of the details. But anyway, when you break the annulus, you always break it with a pair of flux tubes. You know, there'll be a hole there. Flux goes out from the chaotic core all the way to the wall. Flux also has to come in all the way from the chaotic core to the wall, because dB is equal to zero. So if you integrate over the whole thing, you have to get zero. But only one of these tubes, flux tubes, is relevant, namely the one, the direction the electrons are, which direction the runaway electrons, or the electrons are going on the magnetic field. But anyway, the quicker the turnstile opens compared to the time it takes the runaway electrons to transit this chaotic region, which means about 20 to 100 toroidal transits, the more spreading you get, because if the hole opens quickly compared to how long it takes the runaway electrons to find the hole, it's a big hole, which means a big flux tube, which means it hits the wall in a big area. If your hole opens very slowly, then the tube is really tiny when you first open this hole, and it's a very tiny flux tube, which means a very tiny area on the wall, and that's when you get melting. And so there are two ways you can avoid localization. You can do a fast breaking of the annulus, and you can have inside-out reformation of the surfaces. Now, there have been a number of experiments, many unintentional, on the localization of runaway losses. The damage from extreme localization is seen in many experiments, not all. In fact, you go and talk to a lot of experimentalists, and they'll eventually pull out some piece of stainless steel behind their desk that has a big hole in it, a big melt thing on it. You know, it's quite impressive for some experiments. A lot of pictures in JET online you can find of big melt regions from it, so it certainly occurs. But in highly unstable JET experiments and in D3D experiments, they found they knew there were runaway electrons there. You could see them from their emission before, and they just disappeared, and they really didn't do much heating to the walls even. You're just almost like they just magically disappeared on you. And the only explanation, I think everybody agrees with it, they were spread over the walls too greatly to cause any real heating of the walls. Well, if you want to build a tokamak, if you want ITER to operate, or if you want to build a fusion relevant tokamak at all, at big scale, you have to avoid the runaway damage. It's just it's just too severe to live with. And this defines the importance of determining why runaway losses are sometimes concentrated and sometimes not. And how do you make it so they're never concentrated? Because if you ever get it concentrated, you've been had, basically. And so it's important to understand inside out and out versus outside in reformation as part of this. Another thing that's come up, I know we'll talk about that, there'll be a disruption meeting this week later on, is if I see a disruption coming on, can I just throw some huge pellet in and increase the plasma density by a factor of 100? Now, this, of course, throws you way above, by a couple orders of magnitude above the Greenwald limit. And so you expect to get a disruption. And then they talk about the reformation of surfaces and all of that. But can you really reform? You can't get all this 100 times the plasma density out by the pumps on a normal time scale. You can certainly calculate how long it takes for the pumps to exhaust all this. Of course, if they're, you know, like it takes quite a while. And so the density remains, the number of particles in there remain the same. And so if I stay a factor of 100 above the Greenwald limit, can I really find plasma equilibrium, or do I stay in some very chaotic state? In some sense, it's good if I stay in a very chaotic state, because you cannot really get runaway in that situation. Okay, so the next topic is diverter freedom using 3D fields. And this was discussed in a paper that I've just put up on archive. Jung Q Park on K-Star found that one can make the separatrix region can be made chaotic while preserving quasi-symmetry or quasi-axis symmetry in the plasma core. And this may sound very funny. It's a stellar concept. What you find is that's where, you know, kind of the coordinate system that I seem to be named after comes up, that you find that if you can make it so the field strength in this coordinate system looks axisymmetric, then it doesn't matter how crazy the plasma looks. And if you looked at the pictures of the NCSX thing, which was partially built here, you can see how crazy they do look. It turns out you still get perfect, it behaves just like neoclassical axisymmetric with alpha particles, all this sort of stuff. So you can, what this says is if you're worried about diverter problems, and of course at least the Europeans in their demo claimed they couldn't solve the diverter problem, you better come up with a solution, obviously, then you may want to ponder 3D things, because it's quite a different thing. So what are the big issues? There's one of the factors is what I call the diverter fraction. There's the ratio of the pump opening area or the diverter area to the plasma surface. And usually you cannot devote the whole surface of ITER or certainly a power plant to pumps, because you have to preserve some of the wall area to let neutrons through to tritium. People usually think of that fraction of the area as maybe 1% or something that's devoted to pumps. Then you have the ratio of the plasma density in the diverter to the main plasma. In other words, as the plasma comes down, you know, your flux tubes or whatever towards your wall, it has a certain density, and you can compare that to the average density in the plasma. Probably a factor of 10 or so is a ratio, but you could try to control that anything you want. And then you could try to figure out what diverter temperature you need. Why is this critically important? Well, for the diverter to work, it has to get the particles exhausted through the diverter on the time scale at which particles are coming out of the plasma. And that's what this, I give a little formula here. I think somehow, no, I can't see it. That it's the plasma density times the connection length, how far it is from, you know, where the plasma flow in diverter zero to the diverter walls, divided by the density in the diverter times the particle confinement time of the main plasma. If you take that ratio, of course, it gives you a velocity, and that has to be matched the velocity in the blowout to the diverter has to be at least this fast. And that velocity is limited by the speed of sound. It's basically the given by the speed of sound. You look up the speed of sound for a given, it's just dependent on the electron temperature. And the answer is you get about 50 to 100 EV. And if your diverter temperature is lower than that, then your diverter basically chokes. In other words, the plasma just diffuses across the field lines and hits the walls, and you forget all this crazy pump stuff. It, you know, the diverter has nothing to do with the problem. If it's too cold, you know, it doesn't work. And then when you actually get to the diverter, you find that there's a real problem, because you need to put neutrals. Your pumps pump neutrals. They don't pump plasma per se. And you get the thing neutralized. And you actually, if you let the 100 EV hit the all the baffles or whatever, you get too much erosion. You really need to get down to EV levels. And so that means you have to get the density about an order of magnitude higher, to because it has the speed of sound, of course, and to get the stuff to flow in. And so you need about 10 times the neutral density there. And then you compare the neutral density near the pump to the average neutral density in the chamber. And that has to be like 1/1 this fraction I defined right on the first slide. which one over 100. And the reason that's called the compression ratio is what the what diverter people call it. I found it a funny term, but that's what people use. Otherwise, the plasma is a better pump than your diverter. And it you get a lot of charge exchange, you get a lot of problems. So you need a if you really want the diverter to work, you want a big compression ratio. So the question is, how do you control all these things? Now, an axisymmetric diverter, you don't have that many degrees of freedom. Now, people talk about snowflakes and all these things. There are a lot of issues with producing them, but basically there isn't a lot of freedom. If you go non-axisymmetric, you have a lot more freedom than with axisymmetry. You can change all these numbers quite heavily and play with them. And you can get stable detachment. There's some remarkably stable detachment on W7X, for example. And, in the, and then they start operating with all their cooling and so forth. They're, they're supposed to be able to show it for a half hour or so. But basically what you need to figure out what you want to do or try it out, it's there's a lot of computational studies tested by experiments that are required for both tokamaks and stellars. Now, the remarkable thing is a lot of these 3D things, you can simulate them computationally, and actually, it, a lot of times they resemble what happens in experiments. This is the most remarkable thing about W7X, is that I was visiting Garching when they were designing W7X, and we were all sitting around a small table about the size of maybe one of these tables at lunch doing all these designs, which ended up W7X. And you realize you're talking about a $1 billion device based on funny mathematics and stuff. And it was rather humbling to think that he really believed the stuff that that powerful. The remarkable thing is it worked. And so we need to go through that more to figure out what we can do, because you cannot test everything like on John Q stuff on K-Star. There was just a tiny little bit of phase space of all the currents, which would work to control ELBs theoretically. And he found that that was exactly the areas that worked experimentally. It didn't work anywhere else. And so this is, it's very important this to be done. One of the papers, reference 14, is a paper like I just put up on archive, which explains how you can study what's possible and how you can control it by using various things about Hamiltonian methods of magnetic fields. It turns out magnetic field lines obey a simple one degree of freedom Hamiltonian, and you can mix life a lot simpler than trying to come up with coils, much less do experiments to try to figure out what you can do, what is even possible mathematically. But nobody's done that yet. The last topic is ion temperature with electron heating. And this is in a paper that just appeared in June in Physics and Plasmas. It's a very unsubtle point, except nobody seemed to pay much attention to it, that the energy per particle is 3/2 Ti in the ions divided by the ion energy confinement time, if you're doing electron heating, has to come into the ions by the difference in the electron and the temperature divided by the equilibration time. And so you can convert that, do simple algebra. There's somehow in the paper I screwed up something, put 2/3 rather than 3/2, but okay. You always can find something after you publish a paper that's slightly screwed up. But anyway, the formula is basically the same. The physics point is exactly the same. When heating is by equilibration with directly heated electrons, as it is in DT fusion, the ion temperature has a maximum when the ion energy confinement tau EI is roughly equal to the equilibration temperature at time as a function of the electron temperature. So there's a little figure here, which has the electron temperature across the bottom and the ion temperature across the top in W7X experiments. And what you see is the as you make the electron temperature higher, the ion temperature goes up quite nicely. It goes through a peak and then starts dropping as you make the electron temperature higher. Now, at first you say, oh, this is just the microturbulence there. But if you do it all just as a neoclassical theoretical calculation, what they did is show that pump curve still goes through a maximum, still drops even clearer at higher temperature. And it just comes out of this funny equation. Whatever you put in for the energy confinement time, that's what you have a problem. The odd thing is, the thing that really makes you, okay, how do we deal with this, is if the electron temperature is above 30 kilovolts, you found the N tau ion tau equilibration is longer than the N tau energy confinement times Ti you need for fusion. So how How is this possible if you're operating your fusion power plant at 30 kilovolts, which is not an unusual place to design tokamaks to operate? How do you deal with this issue? Now, in the way it's dealt with in present-day tokamak experiments, is do a lot of ion heating by neutral beam injection. But that's kind of a cheat because that isn't the way it'll work in a power plant. And so you don't run into this problem. If you do direct ion heating, it's the problem. And there are tricks you can play. We can, anybody wants to talk about it, we can talk about it. Okay, so let's go back to kind of what I was saying, kind of the first few graphs, people listening to this and recording. The critical path to fusion defines the research of highest importance. Tokamak-based fusion requires the retirement of risks that derive from the lack of robust axisymmetric position definition. You basically tell the plasma where it's supposed to be in the chamber by adjusting the vertical field, and that's a very delicate thing, especially when you have walls that won't allow you to change it in 250 milliseconds and superconducting coils, which won't allow you to make major changes in less than 6 seconds. There are also very strong limitations on what are the actuators to control current and pressure profiles. In other words, it's actuators, just a fancy engineering term for things like brakes and steering wheel in a car. If I tell you what this current, I don't like your current profile, make it sharper or make it broader. Tell me what you propose to do about it. Now, if you have a lot of current drive, you can say, okay, I'll just move where I'm doing driving my current around. But you can't do that in a power plant. That would require far too much power to directly do that. That was something I probably showed about the time a lot of you were born. But it's anyway, you've got a problem when you want. It's not obvious how you do it. But it's also true that the sensitivity of the plasma collapse, or just a fancy way to say the disruption, is quite sensitive to these profiles. Everybody, I think, agrees with that. If we put a really crazy current profile in there, I'll get a strong tearing mode, and that's the end of that as far as the eruption goes. And then the question, of course, you may debate this, but it's an unreliability predictions on the required time scale for plasma shutdown. If the plasma shutdown is 60 seconds, which is the most rapid I've seen in ETER, I don't even sure I believe it, but 15 minutes is more likely, like it. Can I really know anything 15 minutes in the future that tells me whether I should be trying to get my current set down? And that's the way you drive your car normally. If you're driving under terrible conditions, you try to drive slowly enough that you feel like you can stop your car as quick before you crash into somebody. But anyway, this is a thing, there's a paper I put up a couple of years ago on nuclear fusion. And it basically, so in the abstract, steering tokamak plasmas is commonly viewed as a way to avoid disruptions and runaway electrons. Plasma steering sounds as safe as driving to work, but will be shown to be more closely resemble driving at high speed through a dense fog on an icy road. And so the dense fog says that you really don't know far enough ahead what's going to happen. That's the trouble with fog. I can't see way down the road, so I don't have time to react when things don't come clear to me. And being on an icy road says, well, throw the car into a skid, it's not so trivial to recover. And that's kind of a quick way to summarize this. And of course, the purpose of this paper was not, you could say I was being a little bit nasty. What I was really trying to say is, these are the issues that have to be dealt with before we can build a tokamak power plant. And it's not clear how you deal with them, but it better be clear before you really try to build it. And how, of course, you could say how will things turn out in Spark and Arc, and speculate about that. And these are the very topics I was trying to discuss, things that are fairly simple. And the shutdown, experimental simulation, reformation of magnetic surfaces, runaway electrons, the vertical freedom you have using 3D fields, and ion temperature behavior when you have electron heating. And these should provide a focus for theory and computations. Now that's, of course, I think PPL always has a special role here. I mean, traditionally PPL kind of viewed itself as kind of the intellectual center of the World Fusion Program. So people should be trying to, it's something we should all be thinking about. Everybody here at PPL should be thinking about everybody else. And hopefully you have other talks about people and say what can you say? Anyway, that's the, and then the last thing is just all these references, which you can't read here, but you can certainly get the view graphs and read them off. I didn't get any questions, by the way, which is somewhat disturbing because as a theorist, I always have theories. And if I don't get any questions, I assume you either understood everything, you understand absolutely nothing. And I always have a theory about which is the better approximation. But anyway, we can see if we can get any questions.
Maybe we're just being courteous.
Let's thank the last
speaker. Yes.
So on the flux surface destruction, reformation, all the dynamics of that, where do we stand in the modeling, but also the experimental, maybe interpretation of presence or lack of the flux surfaces?
Well, the experimental interpretation, I think that's something that's very important for people like you or other experimentalists here to try to put together. How do I know on that time scale of the reformation after the disruption, before the current has got decay time of the current, are the central surfaces chaotic and there's a confining annulus, or is, you know, what's going on? What does this thing basically look like? Now, there are a number of simulations. Some get one answer and some get the other. I was talking with Nate about it, and Barraro, he's done a number. And then he said, well, one of the problems is we don't have a realistic parallel heat conductivity in our codes. And this is what I keep trying to say is the codes only go so far that somebody has to sit back and ask what could change the answer totally. And it requires, there's no simple answer to that question. Doubling your mesh doesn't answer the question, of course. And same thing with a lot of the things with the breakup as well, how that works is quite subtle.
Well, a couple of comments. One is the thermal quench itself and or any partial loss of control can also liberate impurities due to some plasma wall interaction, which is pretty unpredictable.
I also agree with that.
I don't know if it matters or not for the flux surface reformation physics or not. Is there any insight in that?
Yes, it does, unless you get to conditions in which runaways cannot occur. In other words, if you get to such high densities, and of course, like I said, it's actually much easier to deal with the runaway problem in a non-nuclear machine than in a nuclear machine. And this is very unfortunate from a programmatic person's point of view, because you don't want to get all your surprises the first day you try. You know, actually, it takes a while. The radioactivity to build up in the walls, and what was working perfectly fine before, you know, starts melting walls on you. You know, this is not a nice situation. And so we have to be sitting down and thinking, what can we test in present experiments and what can we test in codes and how do we make sure they're actually doing what we need? And it's what I'm saying, it's a very different way than the way we're used to running machines, either PFDR, D3D, or JET, or whatever, because it's, you know, a very different physics regime, an engineering regime in some sense.
What is your sense of what the best diagnostic or signature is for flux surface quality as measured in a disrupting tokamak?
Well, there are a couple of different things you could look for. Of course, if you had runaway electrons, and you could try to figure out whether they kind of first spread very uniformly over the core, and this is not a good sign. If you see them very domed up somehow, that would imply you had good flux surfaces. And you can also look in principle at the TE profiles. If the TE profiles are, but you have to be careful because you will get some peaking with the parallel. You have to figure out roughly what you think the parallel thermal conductivity is. Now you may think that's a pretty trivial thing, but it turns out not as trivial as you're very rarely in the full Brudzinski limit. But anyway, it's a solvable problem. I mean, if
is there any signature of differences in the hard X-ray distribution from centrally peaked to more peripheral as a function of where the flux surfaces may or may not have good quality?
Well, I think it's more like temperature profiles or where the runaways are, but we should be sitting down and having brainstorming sessions. If this is an important issue, we should be, you know, these are the sort of things we should be arguing about at these sort of meetings about what are our proposals and how do we propose measuring it. I'm not saying I can make suggestions to you, but you're far more experienced experimentalist, obviously.
Not on that part, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of the more challenging measurements.
I totally agree. And it's on a short time scale. And things are changing quickly. But if you have this big chaotic core, then it's very much like having a water tank holding the runaway electrons. And I just knock a hole anywhere in the water tank and the water comes spewing out at that point. And, how do you deal with it? And if you could keep them on magnetic surfaces, it's actually, if you could assure me the runaway electrons were on magnetic surfaces, it's very difficult to come with a scheme to get them out extremely localized, either in space or in time. You know, it's like pushing an onion into the wall. You just peel them off and you get different places and different times. But if you have it all in this big chaotic field line region, and like I said, it's like a water tank, all you do is punch a hole and it comes pouring out wherever the hole was. And I'd need to get, well, of course, you do get this issue that
the pool of disruptions,
by the way, is there are three things you've got to deal with. One is the power deposition, just when you cool the plasma going onto the wall, that you don't melt the walls or do something terrible there. And that has to be fairly distributed on the wall. You will melt the wall. The second thing is you've got to deal with the forces that if you get big kinks or the plasma slams into the wall too quickly and get big currents going, that is not pleasant at all. And that gets very complicated because of the complex nature of the walls and these things. And nobody's really done that calculation properly. So I put some stuff in a paper if you want to see, you know, suggestions about how one could approach it. And then the third thing is runaway electrons. And the trouble is if you ask, okay, how do I solve the first two problems? I'd tell you about impurities and all this sort of stuff. And then I tell you, but it's exactly what I'd tell you to do if I were trying to sabotage the machine by runaway electrons. And that's what's difficult. If you tell me you're willing to live with destroying the machine by one of these, you don't care about destroying it by one of these methods, I can help you a lot. But when you want to prevent destruction by any one of the three, that's when life gets very unpleasant.
No, I agree. I mean, there's a significant difference between a very slow ramp to try to control the current density profile to stay stable. But if you're going to deconfine the runaways, you want a large instability in the plasma. Mm-hmm. This seems to be the dichotomy. In the modeling, is there synthetic diagnosis of where the energetic electrons go near the...
Oh, yeah, you can figure out easily enough if you do a computer run where they go. They come out along the field line, so it's where they...
Are we doing that? And I haven't paid attention.
But the question is, you have to cut it down... Well, you can do the calculations fairly easily. You know how much energy there is there, and you can try to figure out how concentrated it would have to be to melt the wall. And it does have to be fairly concentrated. But like I said, almost every old experimentalist will have some pieces. You may have one stuck in your office. I don't know. But I don't remember you ever showing me one, but I've certainly had others show them to me.
Making runaways, and even when we did, wasn't as bad as what you're looking at here for advanced TX anyway.
But certainly, there are a lot of pretty pictures, or whatever you want to call them, from jet runaway experiments. I'm sure you've seen them.
You don't even need runaways to.
And it's pretty scary. And then you try to figure out what's going to happen when you induce currents in the walls. They're going to head for, some people say, well, the worst thing would be if the wall were a perfect conductor. Actually, that's not the correct answer. The worst thing is if you had these little melt channels between various tiles that kind of happen to be in a unfortunate place, so the currents go that way, switch from toroidal to colloidal. Most of the currents want to flow toroidally in a disruption, but not all, by the way. And
I ask my next provocative question, we should see if anyone else has any questions or comments.
There are a couple of questions from online. Joe, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Alan. That was an interesting talk, as always. I like one of the questions you raised, at least. You said, why are sometimes the runaway electrons concentrated and other times they're not? And I'm wondering, how can we figure out the answer to that question and try to ensure that they don't stay concentrated? Do you have any ideas of how to at least test for that, or what experiments could be done?
Simple-minded answer is you can keep them on perfect magnetic surfaces, you probably don't have a problem. I haven't come up with a scheme. as Marshall used to say, theorists sit around thinking about disaster scenarios, and I couldn't figure out a good disaster scenario as a theorist with them all on magnetic surfaces. So, okay, fine. If you, and the worst thing I could figure out is I put a big chaotic region in the core and put a thin annulus around, which keeps them from going out. If you tell me everything is chaotic, then runaways go out before they can go up to very high energy, so there's no problem. But if the worst thing is I can have an annulus of good surfaces to keep them from going to the walls while they're, you know, having, it takes a lot of circuits. I forget, you can do the easy calculation. How many loop volts you have going around, and I want to get up to 10 MeV, and you just do the calculation very quickly about how long it takes to get up there, but it's a fair length of time.
So the chaotic 3D fields, like you mentioned, Junkie Park had shown, you don't think that would solve the issue because they're edge localized and they don't really affect the runaways in the core?
Yeah, if you get enough of the edge so it wants to be chaotic, that helps prejudice the thing very heavily to not being able to form this annulus. How far been I can form this annulus and still have a disaster is something that is a numerical issue. You know, is it, if I'd formed this annulus halfway out in radius and the inner half was at the current, I don't know. You know, this is where you get into interesting questions about when does a stable equilibrium exist, and if I do something like raising the density a lot, which a lot of people are talking about doing, does that prevent you from forming good surfaces? The magnetic surfaces are that you don't want to form a thin region of them. That's what you definitely don't want to do. And so anything you do to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Is a good. The other question I had was about, you mentioned the TI behavior of electron heating. I must say I was very surprised at the W7X results that they had this clamping in the TI with increasing TE. And it wasn't clear to me in what you stated. Do you think that's fundamental? Is there a way to avoid that? How can we avoid that clamping in the TI?
Just a trivial piece of algebra. I never took a plasma physics course in my life, so you could say that shows, but anyway, we probably had it in your first plasma physics course if you had one. But
basically, it's just if you put the heating in the electrons, you have to get the ion somehow. And when the electron temperature gets well above the ion temperature, the equilibration drops is T to the 1/2. The equilibration time goes as T to the 3/2, TE to the 3/2, only depends on the electron temperature. Upstairs is the TE, you know, which is how fast it transmitted, but it actually, the power drops as the square root of TE, the hotter you make the electrons. So what happens in W7X is when you get the electron temperature above something, it basically runs away. And, you know, and the same is true, actually, there. Mike Z has looked at all of these out there, but he's done some stuff on that looking at tokamak experiments. You see the same effect if you don't have ion heating. One thing I've suggested, which might work, is more obviously how you do it in a stellar where profiles aren't quite so essential. If you can make it so you have a toroidal alphane eigenmode driven by the alpha particles, and you can use the viscosity to damp things. So it's a very localized interior. So the alpha particles can't get all the way out, but are putting a lot of energy into toroidal alpha and eigenmodes in the core. And the viscosity damps them. And that is direct heating of the ions by the alpha particles. And that's an enormous benefit. Nat Fish, I don't know, it's been a long time ago, 30 years ago, talked a lot about alpha channeling, but he was thinking about other things. But if there's any way you can figure out to get energy directly from the alphas to the ions, it's a huge win. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, it's not such a big problem if you keep your fusion temperatures down at 10 kilovolts. The trouble is a lot of the tokamak reactor designs I've seen have been more like 30 kilovolts for two reasons. One is the current maintenance, obviously the ohmic drag is a lot less at 30 than 10, and the bootstrap current saturates better there. And the other thing is the power density. They tend to operate it because of the Greenwald. If you take the Greenwald density limit extremely seriously, it's hard to get the power density up. That one of the issues you get into, and I go through this in the paper about diverters, that you need enough power density to come pretty close to melting the walls. When you're trying to make money at fusion, you're trying to sell the energy, the power that I should say, that passes through any square meter of the wall to pay for everything behind that square meter. And so I wanted to get the power density as high as I can until you tell me you can't go there, which is when I start melting the walls or something. But I cannot, what that says is, of course, I can't peak the power any place on the walls, because that would increase my cost of the electricity. It's these sort of things you go through that to make you very limited in what you can do. And I certainly hope, like I said, I think these meetings like this would be great if we had arguments about how you deal with each issue. That's so much, that was the spirit, by the way, I wrote that article about steering. I was hoping people would tell me what an idiot I was being and point out, unfortunately, people haven't told me what an idiot, I mean, they tell me what an idiot I am, but they don't tell me exactly why I'm an idiot. I guess.
Thank you very much.
Another question from online. Florian?
Yeah, hi, Alan. Thank you very much for this interesting talk. I'm curious about point four, diverter freedom using 3D fields. Could you elaborate a little bit more what you envision for specifically for tokamak, since I thought originally we want, if possible, have a 2D diverter. Are you proposing in general a 3D diverter or optimizing the diverter design for tokamak specifically for 3D fields?
Saying is, three dimensions has a huge amount more freedom than two dimensions. One way you express it is that there are about four or five external magnetic field distributions you can control in axisymmetry and have reasonable efficiency of field at the coil to field at the plasma. And the equivalent number with exactly the same requirements on efficiency is about 50 in the 3D fields. And so your number of degrees of freedom goes up by an order of magnitude. And so it's a huge amount, an incredible amount you can do. I went through what the big issues are. Now, there are a lot of things you can do with 3D fields that don't have an analog with 2D fields. What I can do, for example, is in principle create a chaotic region right around the core plasma. So maybe have a couple kilovolts at the, on the plasma side of this, and somehow it gets down to maybe 100 eV on the outboard side. And one of the problems with the tokamak, as you know, is I want an H mode, but that tends to give me an edge temperature in the kilovolts range, but I certainly can't let a kilovolt plasma run into the walls. That'll erode the walls too quickly. The diverters just can't take it, and you have concentrated heat load. So I need to get the temperature down as low as I can. But as I said, if you get it below 50 or 100 UV, you just choke off the diverter. You can't get the stuff to flow there very fast. With 3D, what you can do is make it so the field lines will go around and around the main chamber a number of times so that the neutrals that come in get entrapped before they make it to the main plasma. And then you're effectively using the main plasma like a pump to shove your anybody that's in your, floating around the plasma into your pumps, not into charge exchange onto the walls. That's one thing you can do. You can what is true is the length of the field lines of an axisymmetric diverter are quite short. In principle, we get a logarithmic singularity at the X point, but logarithms are never that big. And so it's only a few toroidal transits you make before you hit the diverters. So the length is not very great. In W7X, it's, I forgot, you make 30 or 40 transits before you have a lot more order of magnitude, more transits before you go around. And that gives you more separation for making it so you can get it cold enough or dense enough or something near the diverter chamber so that you can get detachment. And that seems to be about the only way you can really make a diverter work on any toroidal device. And what I'm really saying is we should be looking at it. These issues are very, that issue is very similar. I took a magnet diverter, stellar, just that it's obvious you have to do with 3D and stellar. It's not so obvious whether you do or don't in the tokamak.
Thank you.
But I'm happy to answer more, but
if I could follow up on the question you just were discussing. I think in principle it is possible for a 4 keV plasma to be in contact with a liquid lithium diverter or liquid lithium surface. The density would be very low in order for the net heat flux to work out, and the sputtering rate for lithium can at high density at these high velocities, the ions incident on the lithium penetrate into the surface and don't necessarily cause a lot of sputtering.
I actually agree with you that we need it. Liquid metals have a lot of possibilities, and independent of the pumping of lithium, you know, this tin or whatever, you can avoid a lot of issues like alpha, even very tiny alpha particle losses, as you know, can cause a lot of problems at the walls, but you can stop them with a few millimeters or whatever. And so liquids, but it's also true that if you could deposit the power in there, but there's still a lot of, as you kind of alluded to, there's still power issues that I want to get up to a huge number of megawatts per square meter in the diverter chamber, because you, wherever you're going to pump this gas out, cannot occupy a very large fraction of the wall area. So there's kind of a factor of 100 or something. You could argue about the number precisely. And I'm not a reactor engineer, so I'm not going to try to argue it precisely. That's the order of magnitude.
Okay. Yep. Is there one last question from Mikhail's iPhone?
No. Alan, Mikhail Gryaznevich here. Haven't seen you for ages. Your latest paper will be a textbook for me from now on, and I hope for many other people. Now the question. The question is, when we are talking about ignition and laws and criterion, you and some other guys said that instead of using anti-tau-e confinement, energy confinement time, we really need to use NT tau DT. I think it was in one of your papers. Can you comment on this, please? Tau DT means practically we need to have enough time for DT reaction to happen. So it is more like particle confinement time. But I'm a little bit confused because these discussions were different. So what is your comment on this?
There's something I call tau DT, which is the energy, basically the energy confinement time you need to sustain a burn. And you can go through that, and that's the number you normally see. When you see N tau T things, I always forget what the number is off the top of my head, but anyway, that's the number. And what I'm saying is when that tau DT gets long, short compared to the electron ion equilibration time, you have a subtlety that people really haven't dealt with that I've seen. I've looked in various papers, can't find it. Maybe so, like somebody may tell me I just missed their paper. But that if the equilibration time is long compared to that energy confinement time, how does it
work out? You know, how do you get
the alphas to heat the alpha? If you go to high enough, some direct alpha heating of the ions, but you know, that's where you need careful computer codes to make sure, but we need to go through it carefully.
So simple energy confinement time that was traditionally used for last, I don't know, 50 years, you're replacing with the necessary confinement time for DT burn, and they're different, correct?
Well, no, I'm saying basically what most people mean by the energy confinement time for fusion is what you need for burn. It's not a fundamentally different time. There are a couple saying is there are actually three times you should worry about. One is that time, I called it tau DT. There's also this equilibration time, and then the various particle confinement times. And that there's a lot there that people haven't played with either, that you'd like the deuterium to be confined for an infinitely long time so you didn't have to keep reprocessing and throwing it back in. So when people tell you they want the particle confinement not to be more than 8 times the energy confinement time or something, they're assuming all particle confinement times are the same, which they're not.
And so, if there any way we could make the tritium confined a very long confinement time compared to alpha particles, which are the ones that define the 8 times or whatever it is people usually quote, if we could make the alphas come out quicker, then the tritium would be a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, you'd like to get rid of the high Z things as quickly as you can as well. And there may be some possibilities. And I keep talking to my microturbulence friends, you know, do you do these guys? And they don't. And this is kind of, it's another good example how we worry. People worry a lot about the problems they had, they were taught in their youth, and when you get older.
Correct.
Nice fusion. We have to worry about the critical problems, not what, not
correct. The traditional problems. Fully agree. Okay, great, thanks. Because this is something new, at least for me, in the last 50 years. Okie dokie, thank you.
Okay. Any other question?
I can go on for as long as people like it. You want to turn it off if you don't require to listen to my voice. And...
So let's thank our speaker again. Welcome to the meeting for today. And again, a reminder, tomorrow we have a special meeting at 1.
I'm just going to say, I mean, there's some IND in the slump.